Welcome to ID the Future. I am Brian Miller. Today I'll be talking with Paul Nelson about orphan genes. Dr. Nelson is a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute and an adjunct professor in the Master of Arts program in Science and Religion at Biola University. He is a philosopher of biology who has been involved in the intelligent design debate internationally for over two decades. Dr. Nelson, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, one of your areas of interest is orphan genes. Would you please describe what an orphan gene is and how you became interested in them?
Orphan genes, as their name implies, are DNA sequences coding for protein. There are orphans that don't code for protein, but we won't talk about those today. DNA sequences coding for protein for which there are no apparent relatives, genetic relatives in the databases where genetic information is stored, like GenBank, for instance. So typically what will happen when a new genome is sequenced in its entirety is that DNA sequence data is fed through gene finding programs. The gene finding programs isolate sequences that appear to be protein coding. They have the molecular features that are characteristic of a protein coding, so-called open reading frame. And then these candidate open reading frames, or these candidate protein coding genes, are matched by another algorithm or set of algorithms against the existing database of genetic information, which you can think of on the model of a very, very large dictionary, a genetic dictionary. So the genetic words that we know, so to speak, are already there in GenBank. We've got a new text. It's a new DNA sequence from a species we've just examined. And we take those candidate words, so to speak, we go to the dictionary looking for their matches. With orphans, no matches pop up. So there's an adjustable parameter in BLAST, Basic Local Alignment Search Tool, which is a standard algorithm used, for instance, by NCBI or really any researcher looking at these questions. There's an adjustable parameter called the expect value. And if you set the expect value at a certain threshold, orphans come back with the report, no significant similarity found. So that's how they're defined. So it's a conditional definition. It's conditional on the species. Orphans are, according to the strictest definition, species specific, although some people talk about them at the level of the genus. There is a homology threshold that uses an expect value as a proxy for homology, meaning material relatedness. And then there is the database size. So an orphan can be an orphan when it's first discovered and then lose that designation because one of those parameters changes. But what's remarkable is as orphans are discovered, some of them move into the contrast class by definition of an ortholog. In other words, they find a match somewhere out there in another species. Somewhere in the database, there's a sister sequence, really probably parent sequence isn't the right metaphor. A sister sequence is found, but some orphans hold on to their status as unique, and they are biologically incredibly interesting for a whole range of reasons.
Well, how common are these orphan genes, and what are their significance?
Orphans can be a remarkably high percentage of the genome of a organismal species or of a virus. In some viruses, orphans can be, 50-60% of the sequence has never been seen before. So viruses have the highest known orphan count. But in a bacterial species, typically 10-15% of its genome is orphans. And because of the way they're counted, each one is a unique genetic word, so to speak, their total or their absolute number accumulates much more rapidly than those sequences that are shared. So their significance is considerable given their great number. Right now, the expectation is when you sequence a new species, or a species that hasn't been looked at before in terms of its DNA, a significant fraction of its genome will be orphan sequences. That is, open reading frames found only in that species and no other. So as for their significance, when they were first discovered, they were thought to be, well, these are minor players. Perhaps they're only, in fact, sampling artifacts. that sampling artifact argument has been, I think, fairly decisively refuted because the numbers of orphans are stable over time. Yes, some of them turn out not to be orphans, but many of them hold that status, which you wouldn't expect if they were just artifacts of bad sampling. But their functional roles are remarkable. So, for instance, the freshwater polyp hydra, which some of the listeners may remember from high school biology, the very form, the anatomy of hydra is mediated by species-specific proteins found only in hydra and not elsewhere. In many species of mollusks, the way that they construct their mantle and their shell, their calcareous shell, is mediated by species-specific proteins. Of course, species-specific genes coding for those proteins, which one would not expect on the view that all mollusks share a common ancestor. This is something that I never would have expected. If you had told me, I suppose, even 10 to 15 years ago, I would have said, no, when you find a mollusk, it's going to be constructing its mantle and its shell using the same set of proteins. It's not true. In salamanders, limb regeneration, a remarkable feature for a tetrapod, being able to regrow a limb, appears to be mediated by orphans. Social behavior in bees, and on and on and on. So when the function of these orphans is looked at, they turn out more often than not to be central to the biology of their respective species, which I just find endlessly fascinating.
Well, how do evolutionists try to explain them, and are their explanations plausible?
There are a variety of explanations right now in the literature, and I'll just quickly sketch them. The most popular is that orphans arise de novo from non-coding DNA, something that, interestingly, before orphans were discovered, was thought to have a probability near zero, that could not happen. You could not go directly from sequence coding for nothing, so to speak, to a functional protein. In some cases, orphans have corresponding nucleotide sequences in other species that those sequences, for whatever reason, lack the features that would make them recognizable as an open reading frame. So they may not have a promoter or a start site, but along the sequence you find some similarity. So this is a piece of evidence in favor of the so-called de novo argument, that somehow that sequence in a related species that's not coding for protein, in the species that you're looking at, picked up the elements that it needs to be turned into protein, and this happens quite rapidly. This applies, though, apparently only to a rather small fraction of known orphans. Most orphans don't fit that category. And there is the problem which I alluded to, namely, there's not a good mechanistic model for how this can happen. That is, how you can turn non-coding DNA more or less immediately or directly into something coding for a functional protein, and that functional protein will have a job to do once it's expressed and there in the cell. Another argument, not as popular as the one I just, or not as widely accepted as the one I just mentioned, is that orphans represent evolution from an unknown common ancestor where the evolution occurred either so rapidly or under such circumstances that all historical signal is lost. So in standard theories of gene and protein evolution, you're templating from genes and proteins that already exist. So let's say you have an internal duplication in a chromosome where some sequence is, you've got your original functional sequence, there's a duplication, and now you have a new sequence not otherwise employed, and that new sequence duplicate templated from the original undergoes rapid evolution to give rise to a novel protein, but it happens so rapidly that there is no conservation of the sequence that remains. And because there's no conservation of the sequence, standard matching algorithms like BLAST will not pick it up as a homolog or an orthologue. So on the analogy to language, let's say you've got a new English word that came from an existing English word, but the new English word was, its spelling was modified so dramatically that its connection to the existing English word is lost. So you wouldn't be able to find it in a dictionary because you go to look for the corresponding character string and it's not there. Now, that really wouldn't work for English because if a word, the spelling of a word changes so dramatically that you can't recognize it in terms of its ancestor, so to speak, you're not going to know what it means, right? It's a novel sequence you've never seen before. And there are not now theories of gene and protein evolution that would explain that kind of very, very rapid change through sequence space where all trace of a historical signal is wiped out. So I guess bottom line is I am not currently satisfied that there are adequate theories accounting for the existence of orphans and their incredible number, given existing theories of gene and protein evolution, plus the universal tree of life picture.
Now, in your writings, you mentioned something called a pangenome. Could you explain what that is and its significance to this discussion?
Yeah, pangenome is a fascinating concept that arises with respect, for instance, to bacteria. And what the term means is, let's take E. coli, the workhorse of molecular biology, essential to human digestion. We know a lot about E. coli. Well, it turns out that E. coli, the number of genes in E. coli taken as a whole, so the bacteria in your gut, Brian, in mine, the E. coli strains in any human being, when you start counting, doing gene counts from different strains of E. coli, it turns out that the gene numbers rapidly exceed what would be plausible for a single common ancestor for that species, Escherichia coli. So I think if I remember correctly, E. coli has about 4,500 genes, somewhere in that ballpark. The pangenome is the gene count for all members of that species, wherever you find them. And the number grows very, very big, very rapidly. And in fact, I think with E. coli, I need to check this, but for some bacterial groups, gene counts are fitted to a mathematical function that predicts that every time you open up, so to speak, a new strain and look at its DNA, you will see genes and proteins you've never seen before, meaning that you can never get to the outer horizon of the total gene count for that group. Every time you look at a new strain, you're going to find new genes and proteins, which is frankly astonishing. Because if you run the story backwards to the putative common ancestor of that group, it turns out to have many, many more genes than would be biologically plausible. If you do this for larger taxonomic categories, such as the bacteria taken as a whole, you run into a problem that the original branching nodes have enormously large, biologically implausible genomes. W.4 Doolittle, a Canadian molecular evolutionist, calls this the genome of Eden problem, and it's one of the main reasons that he has rejected the single tree picture of life. Because as you run the story back in time, the total amount of nucleic acid that has to be accounted for just becomes crazy large. So he would say there never was a single cell that was progenitor to all life on this planet.
Well, how do you feel that these discoveries of orphan genes will affect the ID discussion?
Oh, I think it'll affect it tremendously. And let me just briefly sketch out why. If the last universal common ancestor existed, so let's take that as our starting point, our singularity at the root of the tree of life on this planet. From that entity, you can project a radius or a vector, let's call it, that is specified by three things. Requirements of viability. There's no dying in evolution. You've got to be able to leave offspring. Known mutational processes and time. That will give you a complex vector that extends out from LUCA, and after, let's say, 4 billion years, you will describe a radius or a sphere outside of which you should not expect to see genes and proteins because there's not enough time, the original molecular diversity represented by LUCA was not great enough, and so forth. You should be able to map out a space outside of which, when you look at a new species, you should not expect to see novel genes and proteins. Again, on the assumption that LUCA existed and that we understand how new genes and proteins arise. Now, that space, think of it as a sphere with LUCA at its center, that space is very much smaller than the space accessible to an intelligent designer. An intelligent designer is not bound by any time axis or material templating pattern, as you would see with descent with modification. An intelligent designer can go to any point in sequence space, whether for nucleic acid or protein, and actualize that point, whatever its relation to LUCA. In fact, the intelligent designer can really move anywhere in that space outside that radius. So given the explanatory potential of intelligent design with respect to what might be out there, intelligent design has a much more freedom as a theory to explore the space of possible sequences, and we just let the DNA tell us the answer. We continue to sequence new species, and we ask, where in this space are their genes and proteins falling? If they're falling outside the radius that extends from LUCA, outside that sphere, we have good reason to doubt that LUCA existed, because those genes and proteins got out there somehow. And the apparently did not get there by templating from the minimal set present in LUCA. So this is a point at which the predictions that flow from the neo-Darwinian picture of life, universal common ancestry by mutation and variation, drift, whatever evolutionary mechanism you wish to invoke, the predictions that flow from that model of the history of life versus intelligent design, those predictions diverge radically. And we're in the wonderful position that we can just look at species and ask, where are you? Where are your unique sequences located in that space? How many unique sequences do you have and what are they doing? So I, for years, have been a kind of shameless cheerleader for orphans or taxonomically restricted genes because I think their potential for biological discovery is so great. And it's one of the things that makes biology the most interesting science going right now.
Well, thank you, Dr. Nelson, for that fascinating discussion on orphan genes. For ID the Future, I am Brian Miller. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.